Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Yeah, hi, this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I am arranging at this moment to talk with my guest in a few minutes, but I got to talk to him right now because he's from Australia. We're having trouble making contact. Martin, are you there? All right. Well,
You there, Peter? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Is that clear?
I think it's clear enough. You were hoping to get through on the hard line?
Yeah, I was actually, but I can give you the number now if you want.
Yeah. Well, not unless you want everybody in the world to know the number.
No, that's true. That's true. Yeah, yeah.
So let me, because we're on the air live, let me send this number right now. Folks, be patient with us. This is one of the best guests on the face of the whole earth, coming all the way from Australia. And it's funny, Martin, this is the second show in a row I've had connection problems for the first time ever. My guest couldn't get through last time due to a power failure in his small town. So while everybody listens, what are the first two numbers?
It's 6-1.
I got that. Okay, I'll just send this.
Okay. Thank you.
And
I can hear you clear as day. If you can hear me, it's okay.
It's going to work fine. Okay.
Well, we'll just get down here.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll stay on this line. I just got my orders from my great engineer. And Martin, before I introduce you, I got a couple of things to tell my audience. Last week, my caller literally couldn't get through because his town blacked out. And so I spent the hour talking about my new book called Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. I hadn't planned to really do that. I'm not sure what my plans were in the future for that. But it's a book about the biological evolution of guilt, shame, and anxiety and how we can overcome it. These negative legacy emotions that evolution and childhood have given us. And because I ended up talking for about an hour, I put an ad up on the page of Bregan.com, and you can get the Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety book for $19, plus you'll get the antidepressant fact book for no extra charge, and that is still being sold for $15.95. So you get this great bargain, and we're already getting people signing up, even though the book won't be out till December 4, but this offer of two books for one, literally, we're going to do certainly up until just about when the book comes out. But, you know, I'm not sure when we're going to stop it. So, folks, that's available. Secondly, we have our conference is next week. The very appropriate to Martin being on, because Martin is an expert on ADHD. It's about ADHD and a critique of it and better alternatives and how to help children. And it starts, you know what, I'm going to first give you a phone number because I haven't given you this. Here's a phone number where you can call and get in touch with the gentleman who's actually running this show, Michael Gilbert, although we're co-sponsoring from our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. Here's the phone number for Michael, 855-744-8688. So 855-744-8688. The conference starts on this Wednesday evening. I'll be there with Ginger with maybe the first showing of Generation RX by Kevin Miller. And then on that's Tuesday evening. Then on Wednesday evening, the 29th, we're going to have a whole bunch of marvelous guests. And then on Thursday, I'm having my problems here. Thursday, the 30th, I'm going to MC that the second day. So, you know, you can look it up by going to, it's All About Childhood and Family. Google, it's All About Childhood and Family. It's Michael Gilbert's organization. And this should be an outstanding conference. So having garbled my way through all of that, it is my huge pleasure to introduce everyone to Martin Whiteley, Martin Paul Whiteley. Martin is a man I have huge admiration for. Martin has done remarkable things in Western Australia as a parliamentarian and now as a private citizen in retirement. Because of him, Western Australia is the only place in the world we know of, the only place in the world where there's been a decline in the diagnosis of ADHD and the administration of stimulant drugs. I still don't know of any place in the world that that has happened. Martin's also taken on the issue of psychosis risk disorder, or so-called attenuated psychosis syndrome, which was an excuse for drugging adolescents who show a little different kind of behavior of any sort. We'll call them pre-psychosis, and we're given drugs. One of the great atrocities and potential atrocities in my field, Martin's taken that on. And he's now finished his PhD. By the way, he was a member of the Labor Party in the Western Australian Legislative Assembly, and he also worked for Democratic Reform of his own party, which I'm sure made him about as much friends in his own party as I have in the field of psychiatry. He's now finished his PhD in public policy and through the Curtin University. And listen to what it's on, folks. Listen to this. Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder Policy Practice and Regulatory Capture in Australia from 1992 to 2012. Martin, you know, I just have a lot of respect and admiration for you, as you know. Just start wherever you want and talk about what you're doing, what you're thinking, what my marvelous audience needs to know and would enjoy and benefit from knowing.
Look, I'll give a quick snapshot of my PhD, if you like. The idea of regulatory capture is pretty simple, Peter. It's basically the idea that industry regulators will get captured by the organisation that they're seeking to regulate. So the pharmaceutical regulators in Australia and the medical authorities in Australia were in fact captured by Big Pharma, who drove the policy around ADHD. So what I did was I looked at all the policies that had been implemented across Australia, and particularly in Western Australia and New South Wales, which is the biggest state in Australia. And I said, how much influence did Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, the ADHD manufacturers, have on government policy, on the disease treatment guidelines? And it was an enormous influence. And not surprisingly, where they had that enormous influence, prescribing rates went up. And in the rare cases where they didn't have that influence was tackled, prescribing rates went down. So it was pretty straightforward in a sense. I mean, you do these PhDs sometimes to prove to prove what's fairly obvious, but it demonstrated that where there was a big degree of pharmaceutical company influence, and that was what normally happened, we had high prescribing rates for ADHD, and where there wasn't, prescribing rates were low.
How was your PhD received at the university?
Very good. A very good reception. There's been, it's a story that sort of had a fair bit of publicity in the first place. I mean, a lot of the work we've done in Western Australia around ADHD prescribing to children has been fairly high profile. It's got a lot of profile in Australia in any case. So it wasn't a new story in a sense, but it obviously you go through the rigor of an academic process. So yeah, it's been well received. And it highlights the fact that in Western Australia, my state, we used to have despite only having 10% of the population of Australia, we had about 30% of the children diagnosed ADHD. Well, so we're about three times the national average, but now after we've put tighter prescribing measures in place, we're actually a little bit below the national average. Now, some of that's good news because the rates of prescribing in Western Australia have fallen by about a half, but unfortunately they've gone up elsewhere. So it's good news in WA, but not good news elsewhere.
The way you went about this, I think, is worth sharing. What you did in Parliament and how it affected some of these individual prescribers who were doing the mountain of prescribing, as I recall.
Yeah, well, what happened was there was basically a system where the very heaviest prescribers were exempt from accountability measures, which is perverse if you think about it. The people who prescribed the most should have been accountable for their prescribing practices. But if you were a clinician that prescribed to one or two children a year, you had to be accountable for each one of those prescriptions. But if you were a prescriber who prescribed to thousands of children a year, and there was literally one prescriber who prescribed to over 2,000 children in a 17-month period, you were considered to be competent. You were considered to obviously know what you're doing, and you were not accountable for any one of those scripts. So we changed that situation and made every prescriber accountable for each individual patient that they prescribed to. And when we did that, it confirmed that we had this problem with some rogue prescribers, and they were encouraged into retirement. I might point out that the very worst prescribers were actually some of the people that were supposed to be regulating prescribing in Western Australia. They were in fact policing themselves. So we changed that situation and made them accountable on a script by script basis, and they were effectively embarrassed into retirement.
Yeah, these were two men.
It's less than a handful. There was one. There was two who were notorious, and I'm not going to name them. But there were two doctors, paediatricians, that were notorious for prescribing in Western Australia. One of whom was very high profile and a frequent media spokesman on ADHD as an expert, if you like.
I wish you'd mention his name. On this show, we call people out. If you want to mention his name, that's entirely up to you. He's in the press out there. Anyway.
Yeah, it really doesn't matter, but he was, people in Western Australia know who he is, but we have libel laws in this country that prevent me from being perhaps as
people can Google this and probably find his, Google worst prescriber in Australia of stimulants. You'll probably get it.
But he was by no means was he the only problem. And unfortunately, it's a similar pattern of behaviour around the world where you have a relatively small percentage of prescribers doing the vast majority of prescribing. If that can be tackled, you help to break the back of the problem. Personally, I know that we agree on this. I think ADHD is a complete nonsense diagnosis. So I don't think the diagnostic criteria, losing toys and pencils, fidgeting in your seat, being easily distracted, talking too loudly are complete nonsense. They're normal childhood behaviours. So I don't think any child should be diagnosed with such a universally applicable label. But the real problem, the bulk of the problem, is those very heavy prescribers that specialise in ADHD and make their living out of it.
Yeah, then they get into positions of authority and influence. Did you find direct drug company ties between any of these people who are heavy prescribers?
In terms of being, having airfares paid for and, speakers' fees and the like, yes, there were some. There were some payments. I think they made quite a healthy living. We have quite a strong public health system in Australia, whereby the government pays for the majority of healthcare in Australia. So you can actually make quite a tidy living just from that. If you are literally churning kids through your surgery, 4 an hour sort of thing, and this is literally what was happening, you can make quite a tidy living without actually having to have drug company connections. You can actually make quite a tidy living on the public purse. Now, usually that's a good system. On the, you know, we have good health outcomes in Australia, except when you get perverse outcomes like we're paying for, you know, for diagnosis of diseases children don't have and for treatments that hurt them.
Now, it's my impression that good things can happen in Australia with a little bit more frequency than here. I think anybody trying to get a PhD thesis on your subject in the U.S. would run into considerable duress. And I don't think any politicians in this country have been brave enough. I know they haven't been, to do what you've done. I think America's probably the worst environment right now for criticizing the drugging of kids. I just had a paper published in an international journal called Children and Society. And in that paper, Martin, I ask ethical professionals to move toward, I don't say you got to do it now, but to move toward a ban on giving any psychoactive substances to children, period, just none. Kids don't need their brains. Anyone who needs cigarettes or alcohol, which we don't allow them to have, or marijuana, they don't need psychiatric substances.
Yeah, I think there's a, you know, there's a huge amount of experimentation that's... what I think one of the problems with psychiatry, and I speak as this as someone looking from outside the profession, is it pretends it knows more than it does. I mean, I think that's the fundamental problem. Children's brain chemistry is incredibly, you know, anybody's brain chemistry is incredibly complex, and we don't know a hell of a lot about it yet. Yet we interfere messily and end up in many cases doing more harm than good. So, you know, if you were to apply that sort of cautious principle of first do no harm, you would follow the sort of advice that you're giving.
Yes. We have some follow-up studies coming out in the U.S. You probably have followed them. From 1970s project that was done at the Long Island Jewish Hospital and then at Columbia, and none of the patients have been able to be located yet. But the follow-up studies by the sponsors of these projects are finding that the patients now, as grown adults in their 40s, are suffering from multiply increased problems compared to the control group of kids they picked out way back then. Now, the control group didn't have ADHD. It was just normal kids. They had no diagnosis. But the kids that got diagnosed actually really didn't fit the ADHD diagnosis at all. They were that well because it was just criteria from school. The parents found them to be fine, and the school referred them in, and even the descriptions are that they were just sort of mostly, you know, mildly hyperactive, and they had no other diagnoses whatsoever. And now these people, as adults, have higher suicide rates, higher incarceration and mental hospitalization rates, greater obesity rates, less education, less success in general as a group, statistically significantly and majorly so. And I think it's not from that original bit of stimulant drug they got. It's from their getting started on a career as mental patients. I'm sure their obesity reflects that they're now on the new drugs, like new antipsychotic drugs, like Abilify and Seroquel and Zyprexa and Risperdal. Meanwhile, the people who have done the studies are claiming this shows you that ADHD has a bad outcome. No, it's drug treatment and giving people labels that has a terrible outcome. And the outcome's looking worse and worse as these studies come in. Go ahead.
We had some interesting long-term research in Western Australia whereby we had a cohort of 3,000 children that they started doing a longitudinal study of their health and well-being in 1989. So those children are now 25 years of age. And there was a small number, only a small number, but about 130 of this 3,000 cohort that had a diagnosis of ADHD. And it was interesting, they followed the ones that were never medicated, that had been given a diagnosis and were never medicated, and they followed the ones that had been given a diagnosis and had been medicated at some stage. And the outcomes in terms of academic performance and in cardiovascular outcomes were much, much worse for the kids that had been medicated. And it was really interesting because the whole basis of the ADHD, you know, the drugging is supposed to be that, you know, if you don't medicate them now, they'll suffer all these long-term adverse effects. Now, we had, you know, two groups of kids, supposedly ADHD and never drugged, ADHD and drugged, and the ones that were drugged were 10 times more likely to be rated as failing educationally than the kids that were never medicated. And they had higher diastolic blood pressure, you know, which is a precursor to bad outcomes later in life. So the problem is, Peter, and, you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, I'm just reinforcing what you said, is that it's impossible and often to determine between the so-called course of mental illness and the outcomes of drugs. So sometimes people will take treatments and you won't know if they're getting worse from the treatment or they're getting worse because their mental health condition has got worse. But of course, Big Pharma always assumes that it's the mental health condition that's got worse and uses that as a rationale, as a reason for continuing to drug or for upping doses. You see that happen to individual patients, but you also see it happening in a system-wide way, you know, used as a basis for research, saying, well, we need to increase treatments. It's something that happens. It's a common pattern of behaviour, both for individuals, you know, where I've seen children that have been, you know, had some very horrific circumstances, including a number of cases I'm aware of, children have been sexually abused, are given a diagnosis, then no one picks up on the original cause of the trauma. They're given some medication, you know, ADHD medications or medications for bipolar disorder or depression. Their behaviour gets worse and new medications are added and doses are increased and the child's behaviour gets worse and they say, oh, this is the underlying mental illness that's getting worse without anybody ever coming to terms with this kid's been, you know, severely traumatised. This child's been severely traumatised. So it's a sort of a profitable loop that's, you know, a good business model in the terms that they sell a lot of drugs, but doesn't do kids any good whatsoever. Does them incredible harm. They get abused initially and then they get chemically abused.
I am so glad that you're using the language of abuse, Martin. We just need to talk about that more and more. Giving psychiatric drugs to children is an abuse. I don't think that the parents are abusive necessarily. They may be. But the doctors who are giving these drugs are abusing children. And we're also overlooking, and I'm so glad you brought that up too, the fact that childhood trauma is what causes children to be upset. It doesn't come out of the blue. It doesn't come out of their genes. It comes out of stuff that's happened to them in childhood, whether it's an ongoing divorce or just covert fighting in the family among the parents or lack of discipline, parents who themselves have been abused and are afraid to even exert any authority with their children, or whether it's authoritarian parents who are really, really suppressing their children, whether it's sexual abuse, whether it's school problems with kids being teased and ridiculed and bullied in school. Kids have problems for reasons. And I hope in the future of humankind we'll look back on this era as just bizarre, that we took the kids who were being harmed, being distressed by their environments, their families, their schools, and we poisoned them. We flat out poisoned them. What a great idea.
Yeah.
It's
There's an Australian psychiatrist that's sort of probably the nearest thing we have here to the work that you do, a Professor John Girardini from South Australia, who describes the labels that we apply to kids. He calls them unexplanations, and he uses that term because they unexplain what's going on. He's saying when you give a kid a label like ADHD or bipolar disorder or depression, you're actually dumbing down the analysis of that, in, that kid's individual circumstances. You're not, you're failing to explain what's going on. In fact, you are robbing understanding because you are saying, you know, this kid has ADHD or this kid has bipolar disorder or this kid has depression, rather than saying this kid has suffered, you know, or this child has suffered trauma in the past. So it's very much in line with what you're saying, and he uses the term, you know, these labels are unexplanations, which I think is a really, really good way, powerful way of thinking about it.
Girardini, folks, you may recognize the name because he's published some of the early articles on the increase of suicidality in children from antidepressant drugs. And he's a very fine researcher and a psychiatrist. It's a miracle. The data you gave is so stunning, and you've talked about it with me before, and maybe even when you were on the show before, indicating, you know, that we have these follow-ups on children and the kids diagnosed with ADHD but not drugged do so much better than the kids diagnosed with drug. Has that data ever gone beyond a government report and been published in a scientific article?
Peter, it is amazing how little enthusiasm there's been for a follow-up of that study. I was part of a group that included that was set up in Western Australia that had myself on it and had some people with completely the opposite views on ADHD on it. So it was a very robust committee process. They actually designed the original study. They said, oh, look, this will be a really useful source. Let's look at this study called the RAIN study, this longitudinal study, and, you know, examine the information. As soon as the results saw the light of day, they started to criticise their own methodology. They said the sample size is too small. You know, and they started to try and, you know, engage in what's called post hoc adjustment. So adjust the methods of conducting the research after the research has showed what it's shown. So there is a really, there is ongoing work. That data was collected was when these children were 17, but believe it or not, it's taken 8 years and the process is ongoing, but there's no great enthusiasm for it. And it's, you know, I've had to sort of drag it along, kicking and screaming, and it's gone incredibly slowly. But it is happening, but far, far too slowly. Now, I'm sure if it had shown the opposite, and there'd been some positive, you know, outcomes from drugging, there would have been great enthusiasm for continuing the research. Yeah. So and what was actually disturbing was they actually decided, they tried to argue we shouldn't publish these results. And in fact, what the study did show was that if you compared the kids that were diagnosed ADHD and you compared their life outcome to the kids that were never, that had not got a diagnosis of ADHD, so the vast majority of kids in the study, the kids that had been diagnosed with ADHD had worse life outcomes. That's the study they wanted to publish, not the comparison of those ADHD medicated versus those ADHD unmedicated. So they wanted to publish the stuff that actually reinforced their worldview, but of course, you know, fortunately there was myself and one or two other people on this committee that said, no, we're not going to do that, we're going to stick with what we originally planned. But there hasn't been as much work, much follow-up work done on it as there should, which is really.
Now that you have a PhD, maybe you could put that data together as a preliminary study along with a discussion of what happened. And I certainly could help you find a journal for that, or I could even be a second author on that. I think data should come out, and the discussion of what these people did should come out.
Yeah, it has been. It's part of my PhD thesis. It's actually written in my PhD thesis. It's also written in a book I wrote in 2010. So that
gotta
process
get in,
has
I want to get it in the scientific literature. We're going to go to break. Yeah. I'm talking with a wonderful man, as you all can tell by now, Martin Whiteley. He's a former parliamentarian in Western Australia, and he continues his good work. And some of you who are really in on what's happening know that Australia has now passed some legislation trying to some extent to control shock treatment and to stop it in children. And Martin Whiteley was an important person in that regard, too, and we will talk about that when we get back, let's go. It's a little late here. Let's go to the music. W-H-I-T-E-L-Y. Martin is from Western Australia. You can easily, he was a parliamentary member. He's got a great website on ADHD. You can get his thesis, by the way, that we've been talking about. He doesn't promote himself much, but that I can tell you that thesis is online. You can find it by searching his name. This is a man who's just doing great work. This is a show that I hope everyone will listen to. I want to make one moral comment here. You know, it's hard for those of us who try to do good, like I'm sure just about every one of my listeners, to believe there are people out there who act in an evil fashion on evil motives. And this description, and I'm not going to ask Martin to confirm this, but this description of the doctors putting in research that they think is going to help them, it then shows the drug is harmful. They then criticize their own mythology, their own methodology, not their own mythology. And then they don't want to publish the data that shows the drugs are harmful. Instead, they want to publish some other data that's not nearly as important. This is the way the world goes, but don't be dismayed. You're talking with Martin Whiteley, who has not been dismayed, but instead motivated. And, you know, I've been motivated by this, and you can be motivated by this. It's just so much, so important for those of us who are decently motivated to get out there and deal with the folks who aren't. And with that, we're going to go on and talk about a bunch of different things. I promised we're going to talk about the ECT legislation in Australia. We're going to talk about this horrendous psychosis risk disorder, the attempt to drug kids who aren't even diagnosed with psychosis, to drug them with antipsychotic drugs. We're going to talk about something very interesting called the birth date effect and how it influences the diagnosis of ADHD. Martin, where do you want to begin? We got to get all this in 20 minutes or so.
Well, maybe the birth date effect, if you like.
Sure.
It's quite stunning. There was research that came out of this, two studies in the US followed by a very large study in Canada, a review of the record of 900,000 children in British Columbia that showed that the children that were born in the last month of the school year were much more likely than the kids born in the first month of the school year. So the youngest kids in the class were much more likely than the oldest kids in the class to be diagnosed and drugged for ADHD. For girls, it was like a 77% increase in risk, and for boys, it was about a 45% increase in risk, which just reinforces the absurdity of the diagnosis. I mean, what you're actually diagnosing there is immaturity, because, you know, when children are 6 years old and you know, their first years at school, some of them are nearly 20% older than the oldest ones are nearly 20% older than the youngest ones in the class. So that study in Canada, which as I said was very large scale, came up with the same findings as two smaller scale studies in the US, and we're actually now undertaking some research in Australia where we're getting access to the data for children that are medicated for ADHD. And I keep falling into that trap of using the word medicated, because it implies that it isn't really accurate, is it? They're drugged.
And poisoned.
You're right, drugged.
Poisoned.
Exactly. And to see if that same pattern of behaviour exists here. But I think that study, more than anything to me, shows how absurd and unscientific the diagnostic criteria are.
It's a great point. It's very straightforward, if it wasn't clear to folks, that the youngest kids in the class are the ones who are getting the greater portion of diagnosis of ADHD. And, of course, they make more demands on the teacher to help them grow up and pay attention, and how nice if they can just be drugged into submission and go along with whatever they're told without learning anything. It's dreadful. It's dreadful. Anything more about that, or you want to go on to the psychosis? That's another horror story.
Yeah. that is a real concern in Australia. I mean, there was a push leading up to the publication of DSM-5 to include psychosis risk disorder in the body of DSM-5. And just very briefly, psychosis risk disorder is this idea that you can spot people who are at risk of becoming psychotic before they become psychotic. And one of the great proponents of that in Australia and internationally was a doctor called Professor Pat McGorry, who is something of a darling of the media in Australia now. He was a famous proponent of this idea of what he called spotting people at ultra high risk of becoming psychotic. And his theory was that if you could spot them, you could get in early, you could intervene. Now, he had experimented with the use of antipsychotics as a method of preventing people going on to become psychotic, which, you know, to me is absurd. Now, you know, in theory it sounds okay. You know, it's a sort of stitching time saves nine philosophy. If you can get in there and identify who's going to become psychotic and you can help them before they become psychotic, why wouldn't you do it? Well, there's only two problems with the theory, and Professor McGorry's been unable to accept these problems. Firstly, you can't spot who becomes psychotic. The people identified as being at ultra high risk, 9 out of 10 of them never go on to develop psychosis. 9 out of 10 of them, you know, are just going through a period of trauma in their lives. These are young people, typically in the sort of the 16 to 25 age bracket. So you can't spot who is going to become psychotic with any degree of reliability. And even if you do and you give them the treatments, the interventions, the long-term research shows it doesn't help. There's no better outcomes for those that are diagnosed being at ultra high risk. Now, fortunately, there was a significant international backlash to this, led by Professor Alan Francis, who's an interesting man in many regards, and that stopped it being put in the body of the DSM-5. But it hasn't killed the idea, and Professor McGorry is rolling out clinics all over Australia with government support designed in part to help spot those at risk of becoming psychotic. So it's a fight we're having in Australia, and at the moment you couldn't say we're winning, but it is a great concern, this whole idea of preventative psychiatry, this whole idea that you can get in there and aggressively intervene with people before they become ill, and there are other people who promote the same thing for depression and anxiety and a whole range of disorders. So it's a new frontier, and it's a disturbing frontier because it's actually, you know, about people who actually don't exhibit any recognised psychiatric disorders, and in some cases using medications to try and prevent it, which is just, you know, my way of thinking, just, bizarre and out of control.
I would add to it that we now have incontrovertible evidence that the so-called antipsychotic drugs are causing brain shrinkage and dementia in a high rate in patients who have been exposed to them, sometimes just for months, that they are shortening the lifespan, perhaps up as high as by 20 years, so they're not going to be seeing elderly people on these drugs since their childhood, that they, we now know, cause metabolic syndrome, which shortens the lifespan, that's obesity, elevated blood sugar, diabetes, elevated cholesterol, heart arrhythmias, and death. I mean, the litany of how poisonous the so-called antipsychotic drugs are is just incredible. And we also know how they work, those of us who want to be honest. They simply work by causing a lobotomy. They all disrupt dopamine, and dopamine's a major neurotransmitter of the frontal lobes. So you zombify somebody. It's so bad. It's just so terrible, Martin. For some reason, talking with you just brings out in me the combination of the sorrow and the outrage more than on most occasions. it's just an awful situation what we're doing to children throughout the Western world, and if the drug companies have their way throughout the world. I mean, we have studies that show that even adults who are labeled schizophrenic and are supposed to do well on the psychiatric drugs, international studies, they do better if they don't get drugs and they have families that support them. The WHO studies, the World Health Organization studies. We got the studies out of Finland that you can, in fact, help somebody through an acute psychosis in adolescence and childhood, young adulthood, by intervening quickly without drugs with family help. So it's so bizarre that this violent poisoning continues to go on. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think it's part of the nature of first world nations, you know, like America and like Australia and you know, Britain's probably another one, whereby we judge things, we're looking for immediate results. We're looking for simple, quick solutions to, you know, to complex problems in life. And it's sort of interesting that if you think about it, some of the countries that spend the greatest proportion of their GDP, you know, of their national income on mental health interventions actually have some of the worst outcomes.
Definitely.
So I'll be critical from afar, but that's certainly the case in the USA. And it's probably a little bit less so in Australia, but it is a concern here. And sometimes people actually have a much better chance of recovery in nations where they have no mental health system and they actually rely on community support. If people become mentally ill, it's the responsibility of the community and the family, extended family, to look after them. And perhaps it's that lack of community and extended family that is, you know, at the heart of many of our problems.
Well, and then we have all these government policies that have supported the destruction of family life, so that people in trouble have less extended family to get support from in our Western nations. And it's not just government policy, it's TV and movies and, all the media that have really discounted the importance of mothers raising children and of family life and extended family relationships and small communities, of course, in all the Western nations are on the way out. And in part, it's, again, government policy. So, wow.
It's probably less of a problem in Australia than it is in the U.S., probably more of a problem in Australia than the U.S., but sometimes I think we have an unreal, in Australia at least, we have an unrealistic expectation of what government can do. When we talk about, you know, increasing rates of youth suicide, et cetera, in Australia and depression and all the rest of it, the response is always, well, you know, the government needs to do something, which I think is just completely unrealistic. Sure, we need to provide services for people that are that are suffering extreme mental illness, but there's this push on to recognise ever lower boundaries of distress as some form of, you know, mental illness or psychiatric disorder, and then there's calls within Australia for the government to act, which I think, you know, it's firstly it's you know, somebody who came from. The parliament, it's a completely unrealistic expectation about what government can do. Government can't replace society and families and community. Caring for each other is a individual and a community responsibility. It's not something that government can step in and do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I didn't know what your thoughts were on that, but my audience mostly knows I'm very much a smaller government person, and let's build up in responsibility in families and individuals. And while we hold corporations responsible, people think there's a contradiction between wanting small government or smaller government and increasing individual responsibility and family responsibility. And also not wanting large corporations to run rampant. These large governments, large corporations, they cooperate, they cause destruction throughout the world. And we need to be much more cautious about any of these huge monopolistic entities, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry or the government that supports it and gets supported by it. Going a little far afield.
Yes.
Tell us about the new legislation in Western Australia on shock treatment and what role you may have played in it.
We just had a review of the mental health bill in Western Australia. The last bill was passed in 1996. And they've just done a review of the entire legislation. Now, you know, there's some good elements in it, but I'd have to say we were coming off a very low base in terms of patients' rights. Some of the good things that happened were, you know, they weren't unambiguously good. We, for the first time, we had a legal restriction on the use of psychosurgery and an ECT in children. ECT is not to be used in children under 14 years of age under any circumstances. Psychosurgery not to be used in children under 16 years of age. Now, I personally argued that no child should suffer either from ECT or psychosurgery. But the government's response was, well, you know, at the moment there's absolutely no restriction on it. So they did put in place some restrictions on both psychosurgery and ECT. Now, it's fair to say no child has had nobody has had psychosurgery in Western Australia in the last 30 years, so it really doesn't, you know, it's not an existing problem. But I guess, you know, a small advance in that there's some restriction on those things. But one of the things that particularly worries me was I was arguing that the practice of making people involuntary patients in Western Australia is far too common. People can be locked up and drugged against their will because they are perceived to be a damage to their own reputation in Western Australia. I can understand people that are severely mentally ill that are running around and are a danger to themselves or others may need to be detained. But the idea that you could lock somebody up because they, you know, they might behave in a way that's embarrassing to the, you know, to them in the long term and you know, I think is an infringement on their individual liberties and civil rights. And the bill certainly didn't go far enough to protect those individuals. But, you know, it was a small step in the right direction, I guess, overall. However, I've got to say, in terms of patients' rights, we were coming off a very low base. The legislation, previous legislation, had been heavily influenced by psychiatrists who wanted to have virtually, you know, unrestricted rights to do as they chose without overview, and we've managed to get a few small protections in place for individual rights.
Well, good work. And again, folks, it comes out so clearly in Martin's work. Psychiatry is only stopped by force. There is something inherent in psychiatry that escalates toward power and control and authority, and it only is limited by external pressure. It is not ever limited by internal discussion. I've been looking at my profession for decades and decades, and I can tell you that psychiatrists don't get together and talk about how to be more ethical. They don't even discuss ethics. They never talk about freedom. They have absolutely no interest in personal responsibility. It's all about enhancing power and control, involuntary treatment, drugs, shock. And if I had conducted an international campaign in the 1970s to stop psychosurgery, they'd still be talking about psychosurgery more than they are. What was your role in the Mental Health Act?
Well, I was a member of the review of the Mental Health Act has been going on for about a decade, and I was a member of Parliament, and I've been up until last year, and I followed that process. But since I left Parliament, I've been working as an advocate for the Health Consumers Council in Western Australia, and I followed the bill through. I took it as one of my responsibilities was to follow the progress of the bill through the Parliament. So we made a number of submissions and we got some fairly broad support for the sorts of arguments we were making about it, improving the rights of particularly involuntary patients. from other community organisations. I might just say something positive about psychiatry in Australia. I can't have any understanding in the US, but the majority of problems of poor psychiatric practice in Australia aren't done by psychiatrists. In fact, the sorts of arguments we're putting actually do get a fairly sympathetic hearing from a lot of psychiatrists in Australia, although they're far too polite when it comes to criticising some of their outrageous colleagues. Most of the bad practice is actually done by non-experts who dabble in psychiatry. ADHD prescribing in Australia, for instance, is done typically by paediatricians. The majority of out-of-control prescribing of antidepressants, particularly to young people, is done by general practitioners. So we have a problem containing the boundaries of psychiatry within psychiatry. There's actually a shortage of trained psychiatrists in Australia, so they don't actually have to chase a dollar. Most of them actually do real work helping really sick people. There are exceptions, but most of the really out-of-control prescribing that happens here is actually done by non-psychiatrists, so it might be a little bit different from the US. And funnily enough, there are some critical voices within psychiatry, but I think in Australia they're far too polite. They don't sort of tend to call a spade a spade. That's an Australian expression. Please put it in context.
That's English too. Go ahead.
Yeah, they're not as critical of their worst practitioners as they should be. But there is some reason to be a little bit more optimistic about the voices within psychiatry in Australia. But the problem is we've got too many people who are insufficiently trained dabbling in psychiatry that are doing things like prescribing, antidepressants to young children despite the black box warning for suicidality. And sometimes, it's revealed that these practitioners aren't even aware of things like the antidepressant black box warning. So if we could restrict psychiatry to psychiatrists in Australia, we'd actually get better outcomes, funnily enough.
Well, for the first time, I'm going to disagree to some extent with you. Certainly in the U.S., too, most prescribing is done by non-psychiatrists, but it's the profession of psychiatry in cahoots with the drug companies that has consciously persisted in pushing psychiatric drugs on the broader community. It's a clear-cut coalition of the American Psychiatric Association. When I've criticized them in print in the New York Times, responded to the New York Times, Bregan doesn't understand, said the Psychiatric Association medical director. We have a, quote, ethical partnership with the drug companies.
I agree with you 100% on that, Peter. I agree with you 100%. And one of the problems is we import the work of the American Psychiatric Association without sufficient criticism in Australia. What I was saying was that there is some good voices within psychiatry in Australia, but unfortunately they get swamped by the industry leaders because the industry, the paid spokesmen attract the money of the pharmaceutical industry and get promoted as thought leaders. So that's our problem.
And also this silence of psychiatrists. I've written about that and talked about it. I call it the code of silence. It's not just shyness. It's an unwillingness to take the kind of risks that you're taking, that I take, that Giardini has taken. But listen, we are at the end of a marvelous hour. I've been talking with Martin Paul Whiteley. Martin was a Western Australia Legislative Assembly member, a parliamentarian. What's the name of your website? SpeedUpAndSitStill.com.
SpeedUpAndSitStill. Yeah, if they Google just SpeedUpAndSitStill, they'll find my website.
Or simply SpeedUpSitStill without an and in it, and you'll get Martin Paul Whiteley. It's a great website by a great man, and it's a pleasure to know you and to have you on the radio show. We've got to get you into the U.S. in the next year or two. We should talk about that.
I'd love to do that. Thank you, Peter. And it's always good to talk to you.
Wonderful to talk to you. Thank you for listening, folks. We must do that research you mentioned. Yes, I want to do that with you. Folks, this is a good show. Let other people know about it.